Welcome back to the podcast, Speaking with Authority. I have spent a long time thinking about stories, the ones we tell our audiences, the ones we tell ourselves, and the ones we tell ourselves about ourselves, the ones that are so similar we've stopped noticing their stories at all. Every leader right now is telling their story right now. And their story might be on what success looks like, what failure means, and what happens to people when they fall short. The question isn't whether you're telling one, it's whether you know it. My guest today has built an entire philosophy around that idea. Cam Awesome is the winningest heavyweight in U.S. boxing history. He's a former captain of the team of the U.S. boxing team, and he's a national recognized keynote speaker, the author of Becoming Awesome. But here's what I want you to understand about Cam before we say a word today. He didn't grow up a boxer. He grew up being a bullied kid in school who ate lunch in the nurse's office because he was too afraid to sit in that cafeteria. And somehow, between that kid and the 12 national championships, he figured out something that most leaders never do. If you don't quit when you fail, you quit when you become discouraged. And discouragement comes from the story that you tell yourself when you're falling short. But what we're exploring today is not failure, it's the story that follows it. So, Cam, welcome to Speaking with Authority.
Hey, do I have authority now?
You have authority. You are an authority. That's why I had you on Speaking with Authority, because you are an authority.
Oh, dope. Respect my authority.
You are an authority. So I want to start with a little bit about behind the story. Cam, a lot of times most people see, you know, your medals or your successes, the championships, the stage. What don't they see?
They should see that. Because it was very hard to do all that. So they should see that. But also it doesn't really matter to me. I did all that as proof of the concept of the story you tell yourself.
Yeah.
And honestly, I thought if I would have won enough national championships, I would have gotten my own reality show, because in 2008, everyone was getting those.
Yeah.
Snooki got one.
Come on.
You get it. Right. So you see all of the hard work, but it's, That's just in between. Here's one thing. You see that I've made it to Golden Glove Nationals. I've won 4 Golden Glove Nationals. No heavyweight's done that. No one sees that I've made it to the finals 8 times.
Yeah.
No one's made it to the finals 8 times. I mean, I lost 4 times, but no one says, there's that guy who lost 4 times in the finals.
Yeah.
No, it's people only really care about the wins, and you're the only one who cares about the losses.
Yeah. And I think you talk a little bit about those are the ones you remember, and you remember those people. You don't remember the wins.
Yeah. No, I've met people who were like, hey, Cam, you remember me? I'm like, no. They're like, we fought twice. And that's how little our wins actually mean. A win's just a reason to celebrate, to let loose, to turn up. It reinforces, makes you feel good, but it doesn't actually change you for the better in any way.
Yeah.
But the losses, I obsess over, I figure out what I did to lose, what I could do next time to ensure I don't lose again. And I improve when I lose. I usually regress when I win.
Well, isn't that funny? Isn't that funny how that works? But, you know, losses teach you so much more than wins.
Yeah. You just have to realize you don't deserve to win. Like, if you didn't win, try harder.
Yeah.
You don't quit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, you talk a little bit about walking home from school 10 minutes early every day because of a bully. You said when you started walking, you started telling yourself a story. Now, you have a lot of series of walking, you know, walking to the boxing, you have walking home early. Tell me about the stories that are going on in your head when you were learning how to craft stories and those long walks.
I didn't understand the concept that I was telling myself a story. I didn't realize there's such a narrative running in my head all the time. It wasn't until high school I walked 6 miles to the gym. And like back in the day, you'd have LimeWire. You'd like illegally download some songs. I love rap music. And rap music is the only place where someone can unapologetically talk about how amazing they are. Mm-hmm. There's no humility.
Yeah.
I've got this car. I deserve this. I'll take you a woman. Like, it's ridiculous the way they talk in those songs.
Yeah.
And because I didn't, like, this is before the MP3 era, iPods were, like, way too expensive. I would just, while I was walking, I would think thoughts. And the way rappers talk about themselves in songs is the way I started talking about myself on the walk. I'm knocking everyone out. I've got all the money. I've got all the cars. I've got the championship belts. I deserve to win. And eventually, if you talk like that, I didn't know when, but I started to believe it. And before I started to believe it, I noticed other people believed it before I did. And I was like, oh, you think this is going to work?
Yeah.
Well, I'm committed to this bit.
Now, did you ever catch yourself noticing you were telling the wrong story before that?
Before that, no, I wasn't conscious of that. Mm-hmm. But the first time I was conscious of that story was I seen a buddy. My buddy, he was 16. He was fighting a 16-year-old, but his opponent had tattoos.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, he came to me in a full-on panic. He's like, he's got tattoos. Can you even have tattoos at 16? He's got to be a man. And even though my teammate was more talented, he lost because he psyched himself out. He told himself a story. A few weeks later, I fought in Jacksonville, Florida, and I don't even know where he's at now, but his name was Derek Carson. And this dude, I think he was a Marine, but he was jacked. He wasn't that tall, but his muscles were like the size of my torso. And I had to fight him because when you turn 17, you have to fight men. And he was like 30 or something. Like, he had a beard. He had kids. And I remember panicking, but I had my back to why I had to fight. We drove 6 hours. So I'm like, okay, this got to happen. So I was like, if there's a way I can win, what is it? And I was like, oh, well, all the big muscular guys I usually spar, I'm afraid of when we start sparring, but they get tired in like 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. It's like, if I can get this guy to get tired, because he thinks he's going to win because he's fighting like a chubby 17-year-old. Yeah, yeah. And the audience, I was in his hometown, and everyone thought they was going to win. I realized, oh, everyone's telling the story, and the outcome is written that I'm supposed to lose. I'm like, what if I don't agree with the story? And I was like, well, outside of the ring, we can tell stories, but inside the ring is objective reality. And if I could just disassociate from my fear and run from him for the first 45 seconds of the fight, he will get tired. Granted, if he doesn't get tired, he's going to kill me. But the only shot I had was him getting tired. And I just ran from that man from the bell rang. And eventually he got exhausted. And I eventually hit him enough times where the ref stopped the fight. So chubby 17-year-old Cam knocked out this guy. Granted, he was just tired.
Yeah.
He was physically exhausted. And then in my mind, it's like, that's the key to winning.
Mm-hmm.
It's not letting the intimidation get in the way. Because once we're in the ring, objective reality is all there is.
Yeah.
Your story of how hard you worked and my story of how hard I worked.
Yeah.
And when those moments where you have to dig deep, Jim, I walk 6 miles to the gym.
Yeah.
I bet you didn't. You're not built like that. Mm-hmm. You don't have it in you. You don't deserve to win. You'll never be as good as me.
Oh, I do.
I'm better than you in every way. No, I'm a better driver. I'm a better dad. I don't even have kids. I'm a better lover. There's no way you can beat me in anything. And I talk like that enough to where I believe it. Yeah. And what's even better than me believing it, you'll eventually start to believe it.
Yeah.
Because in that fight, you'll throw a punch and I'll counter. And instead of hitting you a second time, I'll just look at you. Just so you know I'm better than you. Mm. And then whether that's true or not, the story in your head starts flipping through. You're like, maybe he is better than me. And then you start unraveling. And then your story goes to the negative. And you start realizing all the reasons why you can't win, all the reasons why I am better than you. Mm. And really, it's just a mind game.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah. That's more of the psychology of boxing and the strategy versus actually the physical strength. But it's all in our head.
Everything's in our head.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't even that good at fighting. I just understood the mental part of it. I just need you to break mentally.
Oh, man.
And there's a point in the fight where that happens. At some point, you realize you tried everything. You're not landing a punch.
Yeah.
And then your body, like, it's like an involuntary exhale. Like, that's your soul leaving your body. I just took your soul from you in front of your wife and kids. How's that feel? You probably don't want to fight me again. I'm going to do this again to you.
There's an intimidation in that.
Yeah. And I do with a smile. And I fought in a pink skirt. Just so you know, there's nothing you can do to beat me. I don't even have to pretend to be tough.
Wow.
Because I figured out the boxing part.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's the scoring system. I literally interviewed the refs and judges. If we're playing a game, why don't you want to know every single rule of this game? I obsess over the rules. I asked the judges what they look for, and most of them said clean, snapping punches. Not hard punches. snapping, snap jab. So if I throw a punch very lightly and your head goes back, that's a point. But if I throw everything I have and I land a punch, that's also a point. I'm not going to exert all this energy for the same point.
Mm.
But I have to understand the rules to know that. How well do you understand the rules in your space that you're trying to dominate?
Oh, that's good. That's brilliant. That's a repeatable, that's a mic drop clip there we have. Yeah.
All right. Bars, son.
Let's talk a little bit about moving from, you know, the beginning of your story. You started recreating this story. You're moving from New York to Florida. You're in high school. You have a – talk a little bit about the reputation and how you feel in New York and then going to Florida and reinventing yourself.
So it started when I started boxing in 11th grade, and yeah. I was very shy. I was very reserved in school. I was intimidated by everyone. But when I started sparring everyone in the boxing gym, everyone liked me. And weirdly, boxing gyms, the most friendliest people ever. A well-armed society is a polite society. Mm-hmm. Everyone in the boxing gym is very welcoming and kind. And I felt me at the boxing gym. So I was someone completely different in the evenings at boxing. And when I go to school, I'd be this person. I had a couple friends who were outside of school, and I went to a couple proms outside of my high school area. And I was confident the town over where no one knew me because they didn't know my past. And I remember being cool, like when I went over to Westbury or like Brentwood or something, or being confident. So I realized when I went to Florida, no one knows me.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm just going to be whoever. I could be anyone I want to be. I could have an accent. No one knows. And I thought of the whole idea of like family matters. Stefan Urkel.
Yeah.
So Steve Urkel would drink a potion. He would turn into Stefan Urkel, a cooler, more confident version of himself. And that was my plan. I thought of all the people I looked up to and a couple guys who were like counselors in my summer camp growing up, people I thought was cool. I embodied what I thought those people would be when I walked around, and I was just faking it, but no one knew me. And I said that I was this charming, loud, funny, like outgoing person. And there would be times where I didn't want to speak up because I would never speak up.
Yeah.
But I was like, I created this character. He would have to say something right now. And it forced me to walk into the identity that I created because I was committed to it. Now, a lot of us, we have people in our lives who know us as that late person or the person who's bad with money or as the addict or whatever you had in your past.
Yeah.
And when you're around those people, that comes up. Like if you, let's say you run into your big brother or your sibling. Sometimes you revert back into who you used to be growing up, right?
Yeah.
It triggers old parts of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured if you just start with new people, you can be whoever you want. Mm-hmm. And as long as you don't run into the people from the past, at least long enough for you to develop some strength in this new identity,
yeah.
Those old people can re-trigger it. So mm-hmm. sometimes you got to exit your old space to become a new person.
Yeah. That is so good. That is so good. Forgive me while I turn this off because I'm going to get a call. I know it.
You turn that off and I'll share. After I got all of my success, like in boxing and stuff, or I had a good year, right? I was 8-2 as a boxer, which was crazy for me in my senior year. I got to go back to my old high school, my last week to walk in my graduating class.
Yeah.
And I couldn't wait to go back just to flex. I had abs, like I was in shape. I had a Mustang. It was a green car, yellow door on the driver's side, but from the passenger side, she was fresh. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't wait to show all that off. And I walked into that high school and I reverted into the unconfident person I used to be. I don't know why. It was like my battery came out of my back. I didn't know what was happening. It never made sense to me. And I couldn't wait to leave. And after I graduated, I went back to Florida. Cam didn't work in New York for some reason. And for years, I avoided New York because I didn't understand it. And then I saw a quote, I'm not who I think I am. I'm not what I think I am. I'm not what you think I am. I'm what I think you think I am. I'll say it again. I'm not what I think I am. I'm not what you think I am because I don't know what you think. I'm only what I think you think I am. And when I got to Florida, I thought everyone thought I was this cool person.
Mm.
So that's who I showed up as. When I went back to New York, I was projecting what I thought of them. So I behaved like the person they were expecting me to be. How often do you run into someone after you change and you revert, you fall back into those old habits or those old patterns, or you see your ex and you start regressing?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It happens all the time.
So once I realized that, I was like, oh, I am not going to assume other people think the worst of me. I'm just going to assume everyone thinks I'm awesome.
Yeah.
And if I'm wrong, worst case scenario, I think highly of myself.
I love that. That's really good.
Yeah.
How did you transition to that? I mean, how was there a moment where you started figuring this out? Was it just walking, or how did you start? This is a very healthy way of thinking of yourself, and a lot of people don't have that. I mean,
Before you say it's healthy, yeah. The pendulum had swung.
Okay.
Okay. So in high school, I realized during that walk, the better I spoke about me, the better my outcome came.
Okay.
And I was like, well, how far can we push this? And I realized as soon as I started believing myself wholeheartedly, it rubbed other people the wrong way.
Mm.
Oh, he just shows up expecting to win. Yeah. Yeah. You didn't. You did all this and thought you thought there was a chance you were going to lose. And I realized it rubbed people the wrong way, but I was so afraid to get in the ring. I had to create this character who disassociated from fear and understood if I made certain agreements with myself, if I trained, if I did everything, if I'm in shape, if I don't get tired, I will win. That's it. When I lose, I cry.
Yeah.
Not out of heartbreak, out of confusion.
Yeah.
Why would I lose? There's no reason why for me to lose. I rehearsed winning so much. This outcome doesn't make sense.
Mm.
Yeah. The pendulum swung to where at some point if there's some videos of me winning nationals and I'm like 40 pounds overweight because I figured out the scoring system enough to where I just kind of half-assed a lot of it and would still win. And there's some people out there who can say they beat me because they caught me on off days because I stopped showing up at 100% because I figured out I could win at 40%. Mm-hmm. And a few people beat me and it bothers me because they're going to tell that to their grandkids. They don't deserve that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit about, you know, you're going through this story, you know, thinking about failure and the story after. So you've gone through, you've had some, one of the things that I want to encourage everyone to do is go to your website, Cam Awesome, watch the reel to get the context. It is so good. I'm telling you, this is really good. This is why he is one of the best keynote speakers out there.
Oh, thank you.
Nowadays. But going through this, you had some failure. You had a lot of failure. And you have a story that you tell yourself after those failures. And you've got to go through that story and then tell yourself another story. You know, it seems like you and everyone I know that has depth to them has this trajectory, ups and downs and ups and downs. And, you know, it's moving in the right direction.
It's the stock market.
But, oh my gosh, you know, some of those downs, you know, you have to start fighting that story that you're telling yourself.
Yeah. If you zoomed in too close to the stock market, you'd never invest.
Yeah.
Because there's up and down all the time. But if you zoom out, you're like, oh, over the course of the last 100 years, it always went up, right? You can't really judge your life by any one situation. It's very easy to because you're so close to it in that moment. Mm-hmm. You got to disassociate, remove yourself from that and look at it over the course of 10 years.
Yeah.
What would this look like? Because if you take 20 steps forward but have to take a half step back and you panic during that half step,
yeah,
like you're still over 19 steps ahead, you'll throw all this away.
Yeah. But I want you to kind of tell the audience a little bit about some of the heartache that you've had to go through, because you've had some really large challenges to where you're hitting this, you know, you're about ready to crest that big wave. And then,
yeah, 2008, I qualified for the Olympic trials and I lost immediately in the tournament. It was crazy that I qualified for it. And I was working at Waffle House at the time, and I was like, what do I want to do with my life? I was like, I have the option to go to college because there's a pressure. Everyone that I just graduated high school with is going to college, and they have all their tassels, and they're summa cum laude, and I don't know what any of that means. But I'm like, oh, or I can go to path of boxing. And I thought if I had a national championship and you had an associate's degree and we applied for the same marketing job, I'm going to get it.
Yeah.
If you have a bachelor's degree, but I have 4 national championships, I'm probably going to get it. And I realize a lot of times nepotism is just being likable.
Yeah.
And I realize I can leverage my athlete privilege because with athletes come privileges. You get a lot of opportunities that most people don't get just because you're really good at the sport. And I figured I could leverage that. So I would have to return to boxing. And I thought all the boxers who lost in the Olympic trials either quit or turned pro.
Yeah.
So that would make me literally the most experienced one.
Hmm.
There is no reason why I shouldn't win nationals next year. And I showed up and everyone else thought that too. People let me win because they thought I was supposed to.
Interesting.
And after I won nationals 2008, I realized immediately my first thing goes to how do I leave this sport? So I figured I'm going to make myself captain. So I had a meeting and I said, I don't know how captains work, but I'm going to be captain. Does anybody say no to that? And there's the leader of the team, who, great leader, understood, and he let me be captain because also he didn't care. He's three-time Olympian, Rashid Warren, great fighter, and I got to be captain. And I realized, oh, I'm going to mention I am captain to everyone and try to get as much as I can in life and use sports for something other than boxing, because I didn't want to turn pro.
Mm-hmm. Let me talk to you this about failure. One of the challenges, I think, a lot of people are growing up and, you know, in school and everything else, we're always taught not to fail. You know, an F is a bad thing. We don't want to get an F. You got an F. Oh, boy, that's bad. But the only reason, the only way you get good at something is through failure. I mean, you don't go from a fourth grade band to a symphony player. There's constant failure along the way. You can't become a good boxer. You can't do anything without falling down. But from a business aspect, from a leadership aspect, there are a lot of leaders who don't understand failure is an important part of learning. And I think, you know, a good example would be NASA and SpaceX. You know, SpaceX is going to shoot up a rocket. It'll blow up. Oh, what do we learn? NASA's like, ooh, we're not going to shoot this thing up until we get this thing perfect. And it actually takes longer to do it the other way. You know, how would you advise leaders to encourage failure in the workplace?
First of all, we have to acknowledge that it has to make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
So losses can't cost the business that much.
Yeah.
Because time is also money.
Yeah.
But if there is a number of, like, we can shoot off 100 rockets, we'll lose 10, but we'll have 90 that we know work.
Yeah.
And then NASA is 3 for 3 on rockets.
Yeah.
Would you rather have 90 working rockets or 3?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of that has to do with your ability to identify with being okay with loss.
Yeah.
If you pride yourself as someone, I'm an undefeated fighter, I'll never lose. And then you do lose. You got to eat that. Yeah. And it's harder to come back
because
you put all of your pride on it. So it's easy. So now you have to shrink and disappear. Mm-hmm. But I identify as a shooter. Like, pass me the ball, I'll shoot. I might miss. Pass it to me again, I'll shoot again.
Yeah.
Eventually I'll win. I'll be okay when I miss. But in basketball, at the end of the game, pass me the ball.
Yeah.
Because if you pass it to Steve and Steve misses, I'm not okay with riding home on the bus because Steve lost the game. Right. I'll lose the game.
Right.
And I think once you can accept that responsibility for losing the game, I think you're more okay with missing the shot.
I think that's wise. That's wise. Now, when you're thinking about, you know, going, trying and failing, one of the things that a lot of the audience doesn't know about you is you do stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
And that is and can be brutal. Sometimes it might be worse than getting punched in the face. I don't know if anything could get worse than that, but...
Bro, you haven't bombed.
But you have to bomb to get good. I mean, there's nobody out there. But learning that, I think that's helped your craft immensely as far as a speaker.
Yeah, I would agree. My idea in boxing was, after my first loss, I realized I could no longer be an undefeated fighter.
Mm-hmm.
And when I asked my coach what a loss mean, he's just basically, he said, it's just more experience.
Yeah.
So boxer A has 3 boxing matches. Boxer B has 100.
Yeah.
They were to fight, you're going to bet on the dude with 100.
Yeah.
You don't even need to know his record. Be 5 wins and 95 losses. That's how powerful experience is.
Mm-hmm.
So my thought process was, if I just have more boxing matches than everybody else, I'm going to win more than everybody else. But I have to eat the losses on the way. Mm-hmm. So when it came to speaking, a lot of speakers were saying, how do I get on stage? How do I get paid? I'm like, that's none of your business. Your job is to be undeniable. Are you undeniable? Are you as good as you can be as a speaker?
Yeah.
And my thought was, the more I speak, the better I'll be.
Mm-hmm.
So I lived in my van for 3 years doing about 200 schools a year because I wanted to perfect my message and my craft. And every time I did it, I tweaked it a little bit more. And it's all that work that I put in. Just like I say, when we're fighting, I know I walked to the gym and I did all of that work.
Yeah.
My opponent didn't. I have that confidence. So when I step on stages now, because I did the youth world, I did literally 1,000 talks, presentations in the youth world. So when I showed up to the corporate world, like, oh, where this dude came from? I was putting in work for over 10 years, and I'm almost overnight success.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Overnight success in just, you know, 10, 20 years.
It's 2009. It's been 17 years.
17 years.
I've been speaking for 17 years.
Wow.
Yeah. When I came out here, I won my first nationals in 08, and some dude who lives in Kansas City by the name of John Brown, he owned Ringside, the boxing equipment company.
Okay.
He reached out and was like, hey, I'd like you to move to Kansas City. I'll coach you. He bought me a car. I lived in his house for a year for free. And all I had to do was speak at the high schools and middle schools, take over the gym class in the Kansas City area, and convince kids to join his nonprofit gym. That's how I actually got into speaking. And the more you do it, the better you get. I think it's like I like to think of it as like you're looking at a picture, and the more you do something, the clearer the picture gets.
Right.
And just when it gets as in focus and as clear as you can, you think you've perfected your skill. That's when you're able to see each pixel. And the more you do something, the more you can hone in on it. And I started to see areas in my keynote where this is where I need to pause. This is where I need to speed up. This is where I'll literally grab a seat. This is where I'll do crowd interactions. And I did so much trial and error to even get my stage presence to where it is. It's just like perfecting a craft, just like boxing. And Jim, I'm so competitive with it. I obsess over it. I treat it the same way I treat boxing. You know how rappers, I don't know how much you follow rap, Jim, but being like the best rapper alive.
Do I not look like I'm a rap follower?
like being the best rapper alive, top three, and rappers are very competitive with their art. We just use words. Yeah. Speakers just use words. So in my head, I want to be the best speaker. So I find other speakers I admire, and I learn from them, and I'm always trying to improve my craft because I just want to be the best in whatever it is I do. Yeah, and I obsess over it.
Well, tell me about the kind of the juxtaposition where your story in your head is I'm the best, I'm the best, I'm the best, but you're not, and you're facing reality to where you're saying, hey, no, I'm the best, I'm the best, I'm the best, and you have a mentor or a coach or somebody that says, you're not, you need to work on these areas. Is it just an incredible amount of self-awareness that you have, that you can look inward? Because a lot of people don't have that.
So I'm the best right now.
Okay.
And so I say I'm the best. There might be I don't speak every language. There might be someone who speaks Mandarin who's a better speaker than me. But in the English language, I like to think I'm the best. Whether that is true or not, that's how I carry myself. And for me to do that, what does that mean? That just doesn't mean I work on my speech every day. I perfect my craft. I want to improve my introduction. I practice every day. Like, it's not really the outcome. I don't care about the outcome. I care about the output because I can't control the outcome. I can't tell the judges what name to write down.
Yeah.
But what I do have control over is how I show up every day. And when I say I'm the best, I mean that. And for your listeners who are even turned off by my language, that is what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. It's not comfortable. And I don't say this out loud. I, of course, explain this to you because it's a podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
This is in my head. I never say any of this out loud, but it's in here. And I walk into a room and you can feel my confidence.
Yeah.
I don't need to convince you I'm the best. I've done it in my head so much that I'm not even cocky about it.
No. I think confidence is really good. And you've got to, it all starts in the brain. It all starts with self-talk. It all starts with that. Because if your brain is not saying it, your actions will not meet up with it. And you've got to start with your brain. You've got to have those neural pathways firing. Because one of the challenges I think that we have as a society is we have something called ants. You know what an ant is?
Oh.
It's an automatic negative thought.
Oh, yeah.
And you're fighting these ants all the time. And you can't get rid of the ants, but what you can do is replace the ants with something new. So instead of trying to get rid of the ants, one of the things you've done brilliantly is replaced those ants with a much better belief system and a much better confidence that just radiates. It just comes across. I mean, when you step on a stage, there's a presence about you that I don't think a lot of people have. You know, there's a lot of people up there who kind of fake it till they make it. You can kind of see, oh, that's kind of a poser. That's not really a... When you look at somebody like yourself, I can just look and say, that's the real deal. There's confidence oozing from you.
But I want to make it clear.
Yeah.
I'm not special. There's nothing special about me.
Mm-hmm.
It's just literally the way I talk to me in my own head, because we're all telling ourselves stories, whether it's I'm bad with money, I'm not good with talking to strangers, I'm awkward,
right.
I have anxiety. When you tell your brain something so much, you walk into a room and your brain goes, well, what would a person with anxiety do now? And then you will do that thing.
Yeah.
And like, I walk into rooms where people don't look like me. And I might say, oh, people, they don't think I belong here because, and now I'm weird. So when I approach you, I'm like, oh, you don't think I belong here. Even though I shake your hand,
you feel it. Yeah.
There's something there.
Yeah.
You give it back. Yeah. And then I'm like, see, I knew Jim didn't think I belong here.
Yeah.
And I told myself a story, and I can live in this reality that I created in my head. And we hear the story so often that it stops sounding like a story and starts feeling like truth. So when you have to ask yourself, what's the stories you've been telling? We all have the same hardware for the most part.
Yeah. Well, our brains are wired for story.
But the story is the software.
Yeah.
How willing are you to question every story you've been told? Jim, who do you think you are? Who initially told you that?
Yeah.
And do you agree? Your brain is running constantly on stories, and even the foundation of a lot of people's stories they're inherently bad.
And that's where we get into, are you epistemologically self-aware, which is—
That's a big word.
It's a funny word. It's just, all it means is, how do you know what you know? So belief systems are very, very interesting. You know, most kids growing up believe in Santa Claus. As they get older, they stop believing that. Now, how did they go from believing that to not believing that? How do they go from this belief to that belief? Well, it's all up here. That's the only way you can change your belief.
What if someone really wants to believe in Santa and like it's harmful?
And it's harmful? Well, you know, that's where you have to ask that question. How do you know what you know? You know, my job is not to convince them that Santa isn't real. My job is more of a Socratic method as a coach or an advisor to help them understand by asking them questions Socratically, and they'll understand that they don't have anything holding it up.
Some people have the belief that the very act of them being born is a sin and that they're bad. That is so deeply within them.
Yeah.
That's a story that they've agreed to subscribe to.
Yeah.
I see it to be harmful sometimes.
Yeah. That's where their parents, their society, their
religion.
Their religion, yeah.
I mean, it's they're all stories that we have, and we choose which stories we want to believe and which ones we don't. And some stories give us strength, some stories hold us back, but you get to choose the stories.
Yeah. But it's not just choosing the stories, it's understanding where did your story come from and how did you get that story, and
that's
is
hard.
That story true?
That part's hard. But is that story true? Yeah.
Is that story true? Yeah.
So that's, I would say it's true if you believe it.
Well, there's truth in that. There's truth in that. But there's getting to truth. What is truth and what is, you know, we start getting into objective and subjective things. And so a lot of times when doctors learn how to diagnose, there's a method called the SOAP method. Are you familiar with this?
No, hit me with it.
Okay. So it's subjectively what's going on, objectively, or, you know, this is subjective, objective assessment and plan. So that's the SOAP method. So subjectively, if I talk to a patient, I say, what's going on? Well, my tummy hurts. You know, it's not feeling well. Objectively, it's hurting because something is going on. This is a hypothesis. This is probably what's going on. Let's test it. Let's get an assessment. We figure that out, and then we can do a plan. But it always starts off subjective.
Yeah.
And a lot of times where doctors in medical school get into trouble is they have to go through and they have to say subjective, objective, and they're not right all the time. They say, oh, well, this is objective. And it's like, no, that's subjective. And so learning what's objective and what's subjective is a way of getting to truth.
Yeah. Sometimes I avoid the objective to keep the lie I'm telling myself afloat, to keep myself going a little bit longer.
Yeah. Well, you don't want to be delusional.
But, I disagree. You definitely want to be delusional. One of the worst things you can do is be yourself. Don't be yourself. That's effortless. Be a better version of yourself. Yeah. That takes effort.
Yeah.
Like, but also be delusional. I was walking around just, I'm going to be the best boxer ever. And I mean, turned out never became the best boxer in the world. I cracked the top 10 once, but it was that delusion where I just walked around like I was supposed to win. It rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. A lot of people didn't like me.
Yeah.
But it was because I was delusional. Mm-hmm. Look at him. He's not even as good as he thinks he is. I know. That's the point. Who told you you can't just be obnoxiously nice to you and just believe in yourself?
Yeah.
Granted, every so often I do have to have a check-in with objective reality to make sure everything is still going good.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I go back to my delusional self.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I like that. You have to, I don't know, getting to a belief level about yourself that is, you know, healthy and positive. You've got to define what is healthy and what is positive. And that comes from a lot of times what you've been told, which might not be true.
Yeah. A part of that, like if you're in a position where you're not a fan of who you are right now, mm-hmm. that's great. You don't have to be that committed to you. You can literally change anytime you want. Yeah. It makes it harder to change when you have the people around you who know who you are right now.
Yeah.
So my advice is in 2012, after I got kicked off the Olympic team and I lost my identity and I couldn't figure, and I wanted to be this awesome guy, I joined a kickball league and made a bunch of a whole group of new friends who didn't know me. And I was just this new person around them. And I practiced being the new version of myself. But again, when I would run into people from my past, I would regress into who I used to be until I was strong enough in my new identity.
Yeah. I think identity is really, really important. And your confidence comes from, you know, your identity. I mean, it's all tied in together.
Yeah. Yeah. I think your ability is tied to your identity. And yeah, your confidence comes from what you've seen that you did.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about leadership. And, you know, people are asking you to come and speak at their conference. They're always looking to grow their leaders. From a leadership perspective, having you come in and talk to a group, what is one of the things that they are hiring you for? What are they hoping to get from you?
I'm a good time, bro.
Okay.
That's first and foremost, I'm just trying to have a good time. If I can get someone to laugh, I could get them to listen.
Okay.
If they're listening, I could get them to learn. That's my whole appeal. And my sweet spot is the opening keynote, a lot of energy, a lot of jokes, lessons, misdirections. Mm-hmm. It's a good time and you feel motivated and ready to go into your next session.
Yeah.
But what my favorite thing about what I do is I don't teach you. You don't need to take notes. Mm. There's nothing you need to do. But on your drive home, you're going to question yourself. And that's what I want you to do. I want you to question the way you talk to you.
Right, right.
I want you to think about what would happen if your child spoke to you the way you speak to yourself.
Yeah.
Or if you have grandkids, think of them. Because people like them more than their actual kids. Mm-hmm. And then you think, how would you feel if my kid or my grandkid spoke to themselves the way I speak to myself?
Yeah.
And then you realize, but after my talk, people come up, they're like, oh, I wish my kid was here to see this. I'm like, your kid doesn't need to see me. Your kid already sees you. Kids don't have ears. They have eyes.
Yeah.
They watch you. They watch how much grace you give yourself. They watch how quickly you are to forgive you. So if you're not going to be nice to yourself for the sense of you, do it for your kids. Mm-hmm. Do it for your team, because the story you tell yourself about who you are and what you're capable of impacts the people you lead, whether it's your actual employees or your spawn.
Mm-hmm. That's really good. When you're thinking about organizations and culture, why is this message resonating with so many organizations and culture? I mean, what are they hungry for out of this message that you're fulfilling, you're giving them?
Oh, I think I was blessed enough to never be a part of the corporate world.
Okay.
So I don't speak corporate. I don't speak to employees. I talk to people.
Okay.
So I don't speak the language, and I talk directly to humans, because I think better humans become better people. Better people become better employees.
Right.
So I talk to people from my heart and the things I've learned and the lessons I've learned, which it was just through my experience. I try to be as vulnerable and honest about my screw-ups and my mistakes. Mm-hmm. But I primarily talk about my failures. Like, I've won a bunch of things. And when I first started speaking, oh, I couldn't wait to share it.
Yeah.
And I would share all the things I won. And I get off stage and they'd be like, hey, can you tell us about that one thing you lost?
Yeah.
We're only interested in that part. Mm. And the parts that I was trying to hide was what people wanted the entire time.
Yeah.
And it's still like, even when I was speaking about my suspension, it was difficult for me to talk about on stage at first because I never dealt with it on my own. I just bottled it up and kept moving. And then when it was time to talk about it, I was like trying not to cry on stage. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I haven't processed this.
Yeah.
Because I'm Mr. Shove It Down, Keep Going. Mm-hmm. Because over the course of 100 years, the stock market's always gone up.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm sad. Yeah, life sucks. Yeah, I cry a lot. Oh, when I was living in my van, I cried almost every day. And it's just so lonely. No one talks about that when they talk about van life. Yeah. Like, you speak and then you drive for 12 hours by yourself. And then you sleep in a Walmart parking lot. And it sucked. But during that time, I was just like, I'm eventually going to get on real stages. I'm not going to be with my own projector trying to connect in schools because they don't have a high enough budget to even have a projector.
Yeah.
But when I get on those stages, ooh, I will belong there.
Yeah.
I'm going to walk on those stages with confidence. So whatever it is you're working towards now, use your anger as fuel.
Yeah.
And when you do finally get to that thing, you'll be so prepared. Also, a little bit of bitter and resentment, a little F you energy. That's good. A little bit of F you energy. And then you'll excel.
Yeah.
But you have to start speaking to yourself in a different way, though.
Yeah.
Who would you be if you thought you could?
I like that. Mental toughness, developing that, you know, going through there. Because one thing that I think a lot of people are trying to do is avoid suffering, avoid dealing with issues. In fact, people don't want to think. So they escape into their, you know, little worlds, whether it's drugs or alcohol or just a lot of screen time, you know. So they're not wanting to process it. And it sounds like you've gone through the ups and downs and had to process a lot and come out on the other side. I mean, you're kind of like the phoenix who gets in the ashes, rises again, gets in the ashes, rises again, gets in the ashes, rises again. So, you know, one of your giftings or strong suits I see is getting back up.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
I think I'm just very good at storytelling.
Okay.
We all have my story. Granted, mine just happens to be boxing, but all of us have gone through things and has suffered and has learned from it and has carried on and figured out they were pregnant and they're like, oh, we have a kid coming. We could never figure this out. And then they figured it out.
Yeah.
Everything you've done, you figured out. I'm just very good at telling the story about it, but it's something that we all go through. But the difference is I give myself credit for it.
Yeah.
Jim, you survived a global pandemic in a career where you talk to audiences. How often do you celebrate that?
Yeah.
How often do you walk in a room like, yeah, I'm that dude. Could other people do it? No, not everyone could do it, Jim. You did it.
Yeah.
So how often do you check in and like celebrate with Jim for being dope, for being amazing, for having this podcast still going? Think about all the things you've done. How much credit do you give yourself for it? Not much, but as soon as you mess up, you're so quick to be hard on yourself.
Yeah. That's true.
Who told you making a mistake meant you were less worthy?
Yeah.
Who criticized you so often that their voice then became yours? And now you're just constantly beating yourself up. Oh, I'm not good enough. Oh, I always screw up. What if you told a different story about yourself?
Yeah, that's something that I've been noticing a lot lately is when a thought comes in that is not a good thought, one of the things I do is I capture it, I rest it, and I say, okay, where did that come from? Is that true? And why is it there? And so I'm learning really good to be stopping those thoughts because I think we all have. And I think one of the things that I've been learning is to be grateful. I've got so many things to be grateful for, so many things. And I remember going through some of the toughest, heart-wrenching parts of my life and just having somebody to say, make a gratitude list. And I said, I have nothing to be grateful for. And he would go through and he'd say, does your mom still love you? I said, yeah. Do you have a warm bed to sleep in? Yeah. Does it hurt to breathe right now? No. I mean, he would just go through really basic stuff. Did you eat today? Are you going to eat today? Are you going to get another meal today? And just these little basic things to start getting my prefrontal cortex to grow and that lizard brain or that caveman brain to just shrink and be quiet.
Yeah.
It takes time.
It takes time. It also sucks because America's great.
Yeah.
We piss in potable water.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah.
There's someone who has to fetch water every morning.
Yeah.
And we complain when our Wi-Fi is slow, if our air conditioning isn't working. Homeless people have cell phones.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they're not supposed to have cell phones. I'm not trying to take them away. I'm just pointing out something that we have so much abundance here.
Yeah.
That we will always want more.
Yeah. And most people have never gone to a third world country or seen what the life is like. And I think it, if you ever get the chance to do that, it really gives you a whole new perspective on life.
Bro, with boxing, I got to represent Team USA in over 30 countries.
Wow.
And when we go to a country, Jim, the best boxing gyms are in the hood.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same over there, but their hoods are a little more hood than our hoods. Like, there's been places where there's no sanitation system. It's not that they're dirty people. It's just they don't have systems in place.
Yeah.
And their boxing gyms are just tires stacked up on top of each other that you punch.
Yeah.
It's things are so different. We went to a country, and the tour guide was so excited because he got to be with the team for the week, and he took us to the hotel, and it was just dump with water, four water beds in one small room. And he's like, it has running water.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so excited about running water.
Yeah.
Because he didn't have that where he usually lives. He gets this for a week.
Yeah.
And we were so angry. And for a moment, only for a moment, because I was still angry, I took a step and I realized I'm just ungrateful.
Mm-hmm.
I have it so good. So what would it look like to actually suffer?
Yeah.
Because if this isn't suffering, then I could work myself into suffering.
Yeah.
What would it look like? Because there's someone in an ergonomically correct chair who has Wi-Fi and a computer and a whole hour lunch break. And at the end of the day, they're like, I worked hard. There's also a lady somewhere mining cobalt with a baby strapped to her for 16 hours a day.
Yeah.
She also thinks she works hard.
It's perspective.
Perspective.
Yeah.
Realize that this is cush. We can't even tell how good it is because it's all we have. And I still have a bunch of complaints and with all that and some of this is not we fast enough. Yeah. At the end of the day, your suffering isn't real.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds insensitive, but it's a general statement of the everyday complaints, the first world problems.
Yeah.
Like there are some people have actual problems, but for the most part, the most difficult thing that's ever happened to you is the most difficult thing that's happened to you.
Right.
Yeah.
I like that. Well, tell me, let's see, what are next steps for you? Where's your vision taking you over the next few years? I mean, you're on a great trajectory with the speaking. I think that's, you are just very inspirational to me to see, we got together 3 years ago and we talked a little bit about that. Just
as a barbecue joint, right?
Yeah. No, it was actually the coffee. I think it was Black Dog Coffee. No.
Okay. Black Dog Coffee. Then we met at the NSA event. Yeah.
NSA. But it was, just getting to know you and watching your trajectory and just, it's really a joy. I want to see where your vision is for where you're going.
Yeah. So right now, what I'm dealing with is I speak a lot about identity, but my identity is currently changing right now.
Okay.
And it's something that I'm like battling with right now personally because there's changes in our lives. And I have this thing where I speak with confidence.
Yeah.
You won't understand if I'm confident or not, but this is just my cadence of talk.
Yeah.
But like I've found success in the speaking world. And I used to come from this place of if you don't have a safety net, you won't fall.
Yeah.
That's why I grind so hard. And now I've built some safety nets for myself, Jim. Life's getting nicer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, am I getting soft?
Mm.
And then I still want to be authentically me, but I'm leveling up into this new place in life.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but I wear tank tops, basketball shorts, and flip-flops and socks.
Yeah.
Now I'm wearing blazers on stages.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, am I a blazer guy?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't want to be that. I don't want, and then I think, well, I want to be a successful speaker. And I think, am I just trying to pretend to be what I think a speaker is?
Yeah.
So I'm wearing a little blazer and I'm doing a little thing. And I was like, I don't think you try to become a speaker. I think you speak from who you are. And I'm trying to figure out how to do that without changing the way I dress or changing anything about myself.
Yeah.
But then I think, am I holding myself back by continuing to grasp to this old identity I had that I just wear whatever I want anytime?
Yeah.
So that's something that I'm battling with. And then also I love greatest career in the world, but I want to do comedy. So I'm just going to continue speaking to supplement my actual dream, because sometimes you can't do the thing you want to do immediately.
Yeah.
That's sometimes there's truths in life. You might have people you're taking care of or other things you have to do. And sometimes you have to get something done before you go on to your actual passion.
Right.
And I do think one of the keys to life is getting money and then realizing it doesn't buy happiness.
Yeah.
So it does technically contribute to happiness, because then you need money. Be like, oh, I'm not happy. Let me figure out what else it is. Then you have the resources to do it.
Yeah.
But I do think money is a part of happiness, because you got to figure out it doesn't buy it.
Yeah. I'd take people through an exercise. I said, okay, you got $100 million dropped into your bank. Okay. You sold your business. You got it. You know, rich uncle died. You won the lottery. Whatever. You've got $100 million in your bank after taxes. And go through that process of all the things you want to do. This house, this car, this, you know, all this other stuff. I say, you get it all out of your system. You've done all that. You've done it all. It's all there. You still got a boatload of money. Now what?
Drugs. Massive. That's okay, what people usually go to.
What? And that's kind of where you get to really getting to think about, what do I really want? And here's what I found out. We don't know what we want. Truly.
Yeah, I guess so. I've gotten to that point and I realized, oh, I want to win.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even care what the competition is. Let's play quarters. Let's have a foot race.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking, whatever it is. But it's never, well, maybe it's been about money in the beginning, but it's not about money.
Yeah, money's great. Winning is great. You know, after all that's done.
Not even the winning.
Yeah.
I want to compete.
Well, you're getting somewhere. Yeah.
It's not, I don't care about the outcome. I
want to be in the game. I want to play the game.
Put me in, coach.
Yeah.
Put me in. And there's times where you're in a cold slump.
Yeah.
And you have to shoot. You got to shoot through a slump.
Yeah.
And that's a part of the game.
Yeah.
And then if you look at it, so there, let's say you have 100 boxing matches.
Mm-hmm.
In 100 boxing matches, there were fights that I lost that, Jim, I deserve to win.
Yeah.
There were also fights that I won that could have gone the other way.
Yeah.
Let's say there were 5 fights each that mm-hmm. way. The other 90%, like, I won,
mm-hmm.
right? But over the span of it was 100 fights, I still won 95.
Yeah.
Like, and you have to look at it the big picture. If you zoom in, the stock market looks unpredictable. Take a step back and look at your life.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, you know, just, you got to take a step back and look at things.
I love it. I love it. Well, we've shared a feast, my friend. We have shared a feast.
What's up for you next? What are your aspirations?
I want to be just like Cam. Except I'm not going to be boxing. You know, I don't want to get punched in the face.
I don't want to be boxing either.
I think, you know, for me, one of the things is I like transformation, and I want to do that scalable. And the biggest thing for me right now is I think AI is here to stay, but I think it makes you more of what you already are.
It's like alcohol.
Yeah. And alcohol or money, you know, money makes you more of what you are. So you've got to work on that person. You know, if you have a micromanager as a leader and you give them AI, they can do some big damage, you know, so you've got to transform that person. And so I get a lot of fulfillment, whether I'm working with an addict or an alcoholic and getting them to transform, or I'm dealing with a business that they have got culture issues or leadership issues or even revenue issues that they've got to make that trajectory. And I get, you know, being in the game and being part of the game, and I'm not the person who does 90% of the work. I'm just looking for those little levers that group could push. And it's always around people development. And what's in every person that you got to work on is this thing right up here. And it's all right there. And this is where the challenge is. So if I look at any organization, we said, well, we got 1,000 employees. I said, you got 1,000 brains. Not all of them have the right belief system. Not all of them are firing the right way. So if we can change those brains, then we change everything else. And, you know, that healthy brain is the most important thing that we can get to. And our brains are completely wired for story. So that's why I love this podcast, you know, the story that you keep telling yourself. You can tell yourself a bad story. You can tell yourself a good story. You know, you get to make that decision on what you're telling yourself. And I love the fact that you just tell people good stories. And I want to be just like you, a great storyteller.
So you're already a great storyteller. So we're there.
Thank you.
If there's anything I would leave for the people, I would just ask them, be nice to you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Be nice to Cam and go find Cam. Hire him for your next event. You will not be disappointed. That's all for today. Thanks for joining us on Speaking with Authority and my awesome guest, Cam Awesome.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Thanks.